गौरचंद्राय राधिकाय तदालय कृष्णाय कृष्णभक्ताय तद्भक्ताय नमो नमः। सो प्रणाम टू ऑल ऑफ यू। गुड मॉर्निंग और गुड इवनिंग, गुड आफ्टरनून, व्हाट एवर यू मे बी ज्वाइनिंग in our Tadatmya Sangha every Saturday, 4th Agosti, for exchange of hearts, ultimately, not so much exchange of questions and answers, but hearts and hearts in the form of a question, in the form of an answer, but it has to come with a heart included in it. If not, it's not valid. So ultimately, yeah, we are engaged in this, I like to call it excavation project. So we are trying to explore the depths of mutual reach, so to say, you know, what's the potential of each of us in relation to one another, acknowledging our relationship, because in one sense, everything is related already, everything is interrelated, everything is interconnected. So we are units of relationality, but the important thing here is to awaken from the destruction of that fact, like to acknowledge and celebrate the reality of our connectedness and explore the reach and the depths of that, and the possibilities, how much we can connect with one another. That's basically the invitation and the challenge of an ocean like Tadatmya. Empathy, or same oneness, sameness, no? Of heart. So how much we can touch each other's heart? What's my heart to begin with? What's a heart? Who am I, so to say? What's our potential, and what can happen when we combine units of potential? Basically, you know, every soul is tatasta shakti, which translates as units of potential. So we are potency, and every potency has potential. So what happens with multiple units of potential combined with each other under the banner of Tadatmya, or empathy, and openness to connection and relationality? That's a very courageous experiment. Can be a dangerous one. The whole laboratory can explode, but we will try our best. So here we are again today in another session in our online laboratory, seeing what happens from today's unique mixture and combination and contribution of each other's masala of individuality and individuation. So here I am in Ananda Ashram, as you know, in North Carolina, still for a few more days. We will be traveling to Alachua in less than a week for a few days there, sharing with the devotees. As you may have seen, we will plan to share a series of lectures on self-love in bhakti, exploring such a possibility to begin with. If it's possible to have expressed self-love in the context of bhakti, will be that a narcissistic dysfunction or whatever? So we'll try to talk about that in these days. And this last week has been very nice. We are advancing with the project of writing project on this book, on how everything is in permanent evolution and growth and expansion. Now I'm in one particular chapter on in connection to matter, the material energy, and how material energy is not as inert as we may think. Because sometimes we may say matter is inert or is dead, static stuff. But by exploring these principles a little deeper, you realize, no, there are just different ways of being alive, so to say. that something is living differently than how I am doesn't mean that it's dead or inert. No? So anyhow, just a few words on what's on my mind in terms of writing projects. But we are, sharing with the different devotees and the Tadatmya platform. As you have seen, we will be, at the end of the meeting, we will be sharing some news that you may be already aware in terms of the coming podcasts and presentations from different friends, brothers, sisters. So welcome to all of you again. And I see a few hands raised already. So we'll go there. First is Nam Dharma Prabhu, then Kevin, then Madhav, and then let's see. So you can unmute yourself, Nam Dharma Prabhu.
Rams Marak.
Welcome, Nam.
Hopefully, kind of formulating the question in my head, and I guess it relates primarily to when we're dealing as devotees, well, we age, we get health conditions sometimes. In my case, like chronic health issues that flare. And that impacts lots of things, I guess, as far as sadhana and the requires adjustments and also limits sometimes association. So like being able to travel to see let's say you or Sangha. And so I guess that's part of life, right? We do the best we can. I'm curious, your thoughts on this, but also appropriateness and or methodology of petitioning Krishna for acceptance and healing. I think that's the thing. There's this, I think, psychological blockage around for me for petitioning for that specifically. But I don't know, any sort of thoughts from a more devotional standpoint on managing, like, I guess, more persistent health conditions that create limits around what we can do as practitioners and I think that's about as well as I can put it. So I'll keep myself from rambling on further. So hopefully that's well formulated enough.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I have been talking a few days ago with a devotee from, he's from South America, but lives in Mayapur, and also he has a very particular health condition, and somehow this has been a topic that has come a few times recently. Of course, we have talked about it personally a few times as well on some level. And of course I'm also wondering, okay, if this comes a few times more than usual, have to pay attention to that. Maybe also it's a reminder that we are all walking in that direction in one way or another. Not that something bad, but just as you mentioned, that's life. And if that's life, I have to integrate that. I have to enter, I have to accept that phase of reality, because as we would like to say, God comes to us disguised as our life. So I know it's particularly challenging to how to say, to acknowledge and to embrace God's presence in the form of a chronic disease or chronic pain. And I don't want to sound like a masochistic or something like that by saying that, but at the end of the day, that's the reality. God is coming for everything, especially, and we will mention this many times. If there are situations which invite us to open ourselves, as you mentioned, to gain acceptance, to show up in a vulnerable from a vulnerable place. Those are situations of profound love, but also profound pain, profound suffering. Suffering, and mostly suffering, in the sense that generally we are not that attuned to love. So suffering sometimes in many of our situations becomes not the norm, but there's lots of suffering, just to be realistic. So, and again, I'm not saying that it's something bad. I'm saying that whenever suffering comes, it's inviting us to always realize how l love is above suffering, so to say. Like, why there is suffering in the world, or why there is suffering in our lives? Well, that gives us a chance of embracing the ultimate principle of love, perceiving love, taking shelter in love, and despite suffering, in the face of suffering. And I think those are the most like heroic stories that we generally know in humanity in our lives. When you learn about someone who went through that, I don't know, just extreme examples, but like Viktor Frankl will face such extreme pain and suffering, and despite that, in the context of that, he will contact such depths and connect with such a principle of love and meaning and purpose. So that somehow justifies all the suffering, so to say, like puts all suffering in context and allows us to understand, okay, that was the ultimate purpose of this condition. And of course, I know it's easy to say it without being in that particular situation myself, but anyhow, all of us, in one way or another, have been in situations of chronic pain or chronic depression or suffering, overwhelming, so many things. So I like to make that point to begin with, no? The importance of suffering coming to our lives, but also to show us that how, even in those situations, there is always a chance to embrace love, to take deeper shelter, deeper connection in God, and suffering becomes redeemed in its way. It doesn't mean that I will stop suffering, but suffering is showing me its real purpose. So I think that that's, I know it's challenging and I know it's not easy, but that's, I would say, the devotional stance. So to say, in the sense of, and not only from our school, but like from a universal pattern of depth and maturity, we are not here just, oh, some suffering comes and I just run to pray to Krishna, take this suffering away and allow me just to not suffer, just to not suffer. And that's still, again, I'm not saying be a masochistic and increase your suffering as much as you can. It's just learn to deal with that suffering, extracting purpose from it. No, it's not just the tolerance. Krishna says in the Gita, no, tolerate suffering, tolerate joy, happiness, he says, in terms of material dynamics, matra sparsastu kaunteyas citasna sukha dukkha daha. So that's interesting to begin with. Generally, we don't hear tolerate happiness. But he's describing these movements of nature, like, okay, coming and going, but making the point beyond this coming and going, there is something that is permanent. And it's ever evolving in its own way, but it's permanent in its depth and in its reality. So whether you're having joyful or sad, that's the point. Tolerate that means try to see that in the context of the bigger picture of that things which is underlying that, which is beyond that, which is the foundation of everything, and learn to connect with that, whether in a chronic disease, whether in pain, whether in suffering, whether in tragedy, whether in joy, whether in good karma, so to say. The idea of suffering or happiness on this platform is never meant to distract us from the fact that there is something beyond both of them. So actually the idea of both of them is to point to their source, so to say. So to say, to what lies beyond them at every single moment. So when we can put that in context, now we have to contextualize our pain, so to say. We have to contextualize our happiness. It's not that, oh, I'm happy and I forget about the divine and I forget about the deeper mystic background of reality, and I just get absorbed in, my celebration that I won the lottery, so to say, or I get some particular pain and I get so absorbed in that that I forget that there's anything else but that. That's not the idea. I know it can happen in both directions. If you pay attention, sometimes there is lots of pain and it's difficult not to think about that, but sometimes, again, you win the lottery, to give an example. Of course, there can be so many things. And it's difficult not to think about something else apart from that. So both happiness and distress can be a big distraction, but they are not intrinsically coming to us with that purpose. They bring a purpose. Again, it's God trying to speak to us, Krishna trying to talk to us through those circumstances. But again, we have to to have our eye trained, our mind trained to decode circumstances, so to say. It's not that only when I'm in pain I pray to God, or only when I'm in joy I'm grateful to Him. There are different cases, different people will remember the divine only in those circumstances or in none of those circumstances. But the idea is that, going back to the specific situation of chronic disease, that's Krishna coming to us in that particular form. I mean, I think that's the. It may sound simplistic, or it may sound for some people like strange that I say that, but that's it, the true fact. No, if we really want to, if we have faith that Krishna is Krishna, that Krishna is who he is, that he's merciful to his devotee, that he's a sensitive person, that he loves us unconditionally. If we really accept those core facts, we cannot but conclude that he will be approaching us in at every moment, in every possible way that will be what we need to undergo. And of course, I know that at some point one may think, what do I really need to undergo this? Do I really need to go through this experience, which seems excruciating or which is so challenging? And yeah, at the end of the day, they reply yes. We may not know the details of that, but that's part of what sometimes is called, in Joseph Campbell's words, the hero's journey. The hero's journey, which is not his own idea, no, it's just a pattern, as you may know, or you may have heard hopefully about this. And if not, after this lecture, please educate yourself in that connection, because it's a very important notion, which is not like no a concept made up by Joseph Campbell. It's just a pattern of how reality unfolds ideally, and which is present in every single mystical tradition. And basically, a hero's journey has these three steps. Of course, he gave like 17 or 18 in detail, but the three main ones are, in the words of Richard Rohr, will be order, disorder, reorder. Or in other words, will be, you are in at home, so to say. There is a departure from home, and there is a return to home, transform. In other words, you are in a certain situation. Let's call it home. Let's call it comfort zone, to be more specific. And then comes the forced departure to that, the initiation process, where you enter into the caves of the unknown. When we are put into a situation where it's really clearly beyond our control, beyond what we were planning and thinking, but somehow it's meant to confront us with certain truths about ourselves, so we can integrate those truths, and many times that happens in the context of suffering, so we can return back, so to say, and really fully integrated, individuated beings. So, and that's a heroic journey. Again, to be a hero doesn't mean that, and many times my point is in this journey, hero's journey, because it sounds heroic, the hero's journey, and we may like picture ourselves like being victorious in every battle, and here I am back home conquering all on my way. I know probably you will be shattered to pieces in many battles. That's part of the hero's journey. Now, sometimes the imaginary is, okay, you leave the predictable and you go and confront your dragons. And you think, okay, it's the hero's journey, so I will confront the dragons and defeat the dragons, and probably you will be miserably defeated a few times first, and you have to accept that, and you have to embrace your pain and your grief. You, I mean, we, all of us are supposed to go through these particular dynamics, and not only once. Try to understand that hero's journey is not just one journey. No. Okay, I had to go through that. Okay, I'm done. I'm a hero now. Or the heroine's journey. It's an ongoing process of learning and letting go. No, learning and letting go. No, something new and something old is discarded. Srila Siddhartha Maharaj, in his own words, will describe progress in that way. No, like accepting something new and letting go of something not so new, letting go of something old, no, but accepting something new, and so on and so forth. So I always like to frame this type of challenging chapters of one's life with this word. Sometimes we need some concepts to frame our journey or to give more like structure to our experience and understand, yeah, I'm going through this very complex situation, very painful one, but it's part of my hero's journey. And I need to confront that. I mean, you have that in the dynamics even of Krishna himself, no? If you want to see Krishna in Vrindavan and then Krishna leaving Vrindavan, Krishna returning to, I mean, of course, Krishna is God himself, but even God himself is establishing that pattern. Mahaprabhu himself in Navadvip, going outside of Navadvip, no? These patterns of departure, no? Integration, descent, different things happening. So those will be some of the words that come to my mind in this connection. Like trying to see even those chapters again, and these may be chapters that are, I wouldn't say embarrassing, but in one sense do not feel glorious to us sometimes. We feel like I'm miserably suffering, I'm thrown on my bed because of this chronic disease, I'm defeated in battle, so on and so forth. But it's important that we put them in the context of this bigger picture called hero's journey. Now, this is meant to add heroism to my life. It's part of the journey. I have to integrate my grief. I have to grieve my grief, first of all, no? Because many times we are units of avoidance only. No? We just want like to let suffering pass as quick as I can, so I'm just like, I'm again myself. So no, we need to integrate suffering. So healing has to do with being wounded. No? Although it sounds contradictory, that's the paradox of life. No, you cannot be a healer if you are not in the ones of in the words of Harry Nouwen. You have to become a wounded healer. No? Those who have a wound that has been properly integrated, they have some healing to give. No? They have gone through that process. They have gone through this fire of ordeal. So for some of us maybe a chronic disease, from some of us maybe a, I don't know, a public defamation, for some of us maybe a heartbreak in some particular relationship, for some of us maybe who knows what, different shapes. And I'm sure all of us know something of that. And if some of us have not gone through any of that yet, well, I hope you understand that this is part of life. Not because, again, pray for that as soon as possible to happen, but to just have a sober picture of reality and allowing pain to be part of reality and to be part of, again, of something that will increase God's presence in our life. As I always say, that's how I understand this famous prayer of Kunti Devi, Yadyadpi Padasantatasas Vatatratatra Jagat Guru, and so on. When she says, Bhava Todarshanam Yasyat, Apunar Bhava Darshanam. She's asking to Krishna, give me more suffering or more miseries. It seems that she's praying for that. So you may say, wow, that sounds pretty dysfunctional. Because on top of that, she already had enough dose of misery that more of us can handle in one lifetime. And on top of that, she's begging for more. What's going on? But she's saying, the more this come, the more I have your darshan, she's saying. The more these complex situations come, that's my point. I won't say she's asking for suffering in a sadomasochistic way. She's requesting to continuously be put in challenging situations because those are the moments where she can perceive Krishna's presence more and more, because he makes himself present in those through those, not only in those situations, but through those situations. And she has the capacity to perceive that. So she's not asking for suffering. She's asking for Krishna's presence. And she knows how present he is in those complicated situations. So she got it, so to say. She got the realization of that. So she's praying to him to come to her life in that particular way, which is a very intimate way, so to say, which Krishna will manifest through those situations to support, to accompany, to shower her love, and to show how, as we say, love is above all pain and all suffering. At the end of the day, that's a real triumph and a real victory. And we need to be, it's not us that we need to be victorious. Love has to be victorious, no? Even over us. So sometimes, again, we need to be defeated, but everything else. So eventually we can surrender to love and realize, yeah, that's the ultimate victory, to be defeated by love, so to say, to accept how love triumphs overall, even on top of the most excruciating, complex situations. So life, the whole life, the whole of our life is about that, about learning that lesson. And it will take multiple series or sessions for us to learn that lesson, but it's okay. We have eternity on our side. So we are happy to be given the chance of continuing training and awakening more and more to that fact. So I don't know if any of that makes sense, Namdharma. Hopefully something of that helps on some level or another.
It helps. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So we'll continue. There are a few hands raised. Next one is from Kevin. So please, if you want to unmute yourself, Kevin.
Yeah. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Just a bit of a preface. I've written this question down so it doesn't get too long. I know that in today's climate, the topic of guru can be quite controversial. And I also understand it's a really large topic. So my question isn't necessarily about guru, but it comes out of that context. So my question is probably going to be more about the effect of confusion. So just to give a little bit of setup, I'm just now starting to read Mahaprabhu's Adi Lila. And as I was reading text 44 in chapter 1, which says, although I know that my spiritual master is a servitor of Sri Chaitanya, I know him also as a plenary manifestation of the Lord. So I was reading this and I was thinking that Krishnadas Kaviraj was talking about his particular spiritual master, Nityananda.
Mm-hmm.
But when I read the Prabhupada's purport, it seems that he's applying it to all gurus when he says the spiritual master is a direct manifestation of the Lord, and that the spiritual master is non-different from Krishna because he is a manifestation of Krishna. Then a little further along in his purport, he says that the spiritual master should be considered a representative of the Lord. So my confusion is how to interpret that, because to me, accepting a guru as a direct manifestation is different than considering the guru to be a representative of the Lord, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my question is more about facing confusion, right? And with regard to Shastra and how that affects my ability or actually shuts down my willingness to accept Shastra, right? But of course, if you could dispel that bit of confusion about the purport at the same time, that would be helpful too.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
So, yeah, in brief, to begin with, the guru principle, as we know, yeah, it's complex to understand. As I mentioned in Radical Personalism book, Guru Tattva is one of the most difficult topics to understand, which at the same time means it's one of the easiest to misunderstand. Something is one of the most difficult to understand, it lends itself to be the one of the easiest to misunderstand. Because of the nuance, and this question is presenting that healthy confusion in the sense of, okay, guru is Krishna. Wait, wait, wait. He is not Krishna. He's a representative of Krishna, but he's in Parsama. And he's like, okay, what's going on here? Who is guru? What's guru? And we need time to unpack that, because it's not as easy as we think. Now, if you think that you know what's guru, and your notion is quite simplistic, probably you don't have the correct idea on that. And I will say that most people do not have the correct idea of what's guru. Most people limit the notion of guru to one single individual, and that's guru for them. And many times that ends up being overemphasized and over-idealized to a point that it ends up being many times a personality cult or a codependency template without proper context, and it ends up lending itself to fanaticism and sectarianism and so many unhealthy templates that I think we should have learned our lesson so far, although not yet, it seems. And I include myself in the equation, of course. And I'm not saying any of these to downplay the principle of guru. On the contrary, I mean, in the context of properly chanting the glories of Sri Guru and Guru Tattva, it's mandatory that we take all the necessary time we need to properly understand what we are talking about. To follow my point, I mean, it's not like, okay, guru is that person who is my guru and he is God himself and everyone should surrender to him or whatever. Sometimes we are very reductionistic, very simplistic, and Guru Tattva is very nuanced. One, I would say that one of the reasons why Guru Tattva is one of the most difficult topics to understand is because many things. One of them is because guru is not limited to a person, but guru is a principle, a universal principle that is represented by certain individuals. But to begin with, it's a universal template through which that represents the principle of divine grace or divine knowledge and divine revelation. And that takes a particular form as what we will call Vyasti Guru, an individual. So with this, I'm saying guru is both. Guru is directly Krishna, because we could say, but when I say guru is directly Krishna, I'm not referring that that particular individual that maybe your guru is directly Krishna. I'm talking about guru not limited to one particular individual. I mean, I try to, in the whole chapter on Guru Tattva and radical personalism, I try to talk about this a little bit because, again, there's no clear understanding of that. Samasti Guru. Samasti Guru means the collective principle of Guru, the universal principle of Guru, which begins with Krishna himself. Krishna is the Adi Guru. Krishna is the original Guru. When you see Parampara, Krishna is the first one. So when we say Guru, in one sense, we are referring to God first. Mm-hmm. Indeed, we should accept Krishna as our spiritual master before accepting any individual as our spiritual master. That's the idea. We should understand God is, to begin with, the very source of Guru. And then I will surrender myself to whomever fully represents that in my opinion or in my experience. But that person is Guru as long and as much as that person is representing Krishna's will, no? Through teaching, through example, because he's the original guru. As long as that person is no longer doing that, I cannot consider that guru. Not example I give in the book is a policeman or a policewoman. No, you are supposedly representing the police department. So as long as you are representing the police department in action, okay, I take you as such, and you have some authority in society. But as long as you are abusing that position and misrepresenting that, I won't take you as a policeman. No, probably you are the opposite of that. So to follow my point, no? So in the same way, guru has to be, I mean, there is a department, there's the agency. As we have the agency of the police department and the agent of the agency, the guru as an individual is an agent of guru as an agency. Mm-hmm. Sorry if it sounds abstract and complex, and I'm not being as simplistic as you may like. But again, guys, this is a complex topic. And unless we understand this properly, again, we may over concentrate all the things into one single individual, and that's guru. And if there happens to be a problem with that individual, God forbid, but it happens, then many times our complete faith collapses and everything is over, because we overly excessively concentrated all our ideas and thoughts and hopes of guru limited to that single person, instead of seeing that person in the context of the bigger guru equation, which begins with God himself, who is the original guru and infallible one for sure, Achyuta. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna himself is described as Parama Guru Guru. So he's the supreme guru of all gurus. So in regards to the particular section you are mentioning of Chaitanya Charitamrita, of course, it's the beginning, Adi Lila, the beginning of the Chaitanya Charitamrita exposes the principle of Guru Tattva. There are many things that are being said there, of course, apart from the verse you quote, and it's always important to see everything in context. In certain sections, Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami is mentioning that the guru is Krishna in the heart, and then Krishna in the heart appears, because generally we don't have full capacity to take advantage of the presence of that Chaitya Guru, a guru in the heart. That guru appears externally as a Siksha Guru, or a guru who instructs us, basically. That's the point. Now the point is, are we taking that literally? You follow my point? Krishna in my heart is appearing externally at that individual, and that individual is non-different from Krishna in every single sense of the term. No, because that would be Mayavad. No. If I'm ascribing full godhood to a human being, that's impersonalism. And that's basically the exact opposite of our tradition. And at one point that was done to Srila Prabhupada in his time. And he immediately stopped that, because many of his disciples were saying Prabhupada is Krishna himself, is God himself in every sense of the term. And he was like, wait, you are completely missing the point here. And they were, of course, they were having good intention, and probably they did so by reading some of these statements, so to say, by hearing guru is Krishna or guru is non-different from Krishna. But again, in which sense guru is non-different from Krishna? Or in which sense guru is a direct manifestation? The word here is prakash of Krishna. Mm-hmm. A manifestation of Krishna. Direct manifestation means basically in this sense, it's important. Sometimes we can get, and it happens and it's okay, we can get confused or entangled in semantic issues, you know, in how what words means to us and how certain Sanskrit terms are translated. It can happen, but it's important that we solve those conundrums if our faith gets affected there. So that the guru is a direct manifestation of Krishna, again, you can begin saying guru is Krishna to begin with. So in that sense, he's a direct manifestation. They're non-different. But if you are speaking about a human guru, let's put it that way, that person will be a direct manifestation of Krishna in the sense of, as long as that person is guru, and that's an important point to establish first, and I mentioned that point in my book, when scriptures refer to guru, they take for granted that such person is performing his or her duties perfectly. It's not considering someone who is half-baked adhikar person, so to say. But when the scriptures say guru and say you should surrender to guru, the Shastra has in mind someone who is perfectly exemplifying what the guru should be. Now, Shastra is not talking about that someone who is abusing in the name of being guru, who is deviates, so many things that can happen. So that's important, no? Like the example given in the radical personalism was like, where you read an encyclopedia and it describes an apple, the description of the apple will be a description of an ideal apple. No, the encyclopedia won't be describing a rotten apple. No, that may have a different designation in the encyclopedia, rotten apple. But when the encyclopedia says apple, it will describe an apple which is quote-unquote perfect. in what an apple is supposed to be. So in the same way, when the scriptures, that type of encyclopedia says guru, the idea is an ideal guru. When we are speaking about something else, okay, that we need a separate section from that. So it's important that we bear that in mind, because sometimes I've heard this idea, you know, someone may be serving as a guru, but not doing that service very well, and even engaging in forms of abuse. And some will say, well, but the scripture said that you have to surrender completely to guru. And again, yes, to guru. And when Shastra says guru, refers to full-fledged, perfectly exemplifying guru. As long as that's not happening, or as much as that's not happening, I cannot surrender to that. That won't be healthy, because that's not guru. So that to begin with. So when here this verse says guru, it refers to that. No? Such a personality is a direct manifestation of Krishna, in the sense of Krishna's will, Krishna's presence will manifest directly to us through that person. No? Prabhupada will describe the guru as a transparent medium. So if a guru as a human being is perfectly sincere, honest, and transparent, even if that person is not in the highest level of devotional attainment, so to say, but is fully honest and sincere in whatever stage he or she is, that transparency allows for Krishna's presence to be expressed through that person, provided that the disciple also is equally transparent. Remember, this is a two-person equation. No, it's not like, okay, my guru's topmost advanced devotee, so I must experience Krishna now. No, where are you as a disciple? If we as a disciple have not enough integrity, authenticity, honesty, you can have the topmost devotee in front of you, and you won't perceive Krishna there. So that's the idea. Now, in one sense, the two of them are nuanced. Like Vishwanath Chakravarti will say, Shak Shak Dharit Vena Samasta Sastra Uktastata Abhyata Iva Sadvikinto Pravorya Priya Eva Tasha. The guru is Krishna himself, and he's the dearmost of Krishna. Like implying, guru is a devotee of Krishna, and he's Krishna himself in a representational sense. That's the idea, no? We are not to take the human guru as Krishna himself in every sense of the term. That won't be pleasing to the guru. That's my point. No, that won't be of service to that person. If you go to your guru and say, you are non different from Krishna in every sense of the term, the guru will tell you, you don't understand anything of what I'm trying to teach you. So in that sense, the guru is direct representation, direct manifestation. You can replace the word manifestation for representation. Like you, direct manifestation means Krishna's presence becomes manifest directly to you. You have a direct experience of Krishna's presence or manifestation through that person. It doesn't mean that you need to see Krishna or hear his flute or stuff like that. It just means you will have an epiphany. You will have an undeniable experience, like we all should before even giving ourselves to someone, so to say. I mean, I've been these days studying and thinking a little bit about like the preliminary, and I will mention this briefly because it's a long topic, but generally before accepting a guru, we have this expression surrender to a guru, which of course is not a one act performance, but there is some form of official, okay, acceptance of a person. But what's the preliminary? Sometimes surrender is presented as the preliminary stage of bhakti, of actual development of the relationship. But what's the preliminary stage of surrender? No? And we could say a preliminary stage of surrender is awe and wonder. And whenever we perceive awe and wonder, we surrender to that. We shouldn't surrender without that. So my point is, if you surrender to a person, so to say, or to a guru in this case, before that official decision that I want to give my life to this person, you have to have had some experience of awe and wonder. Again, this type of epiphany, like Krishna is present through this person. I feel that God is speaking to me through him or her. I feel something unique. I mean, it's transrational. I'm not calculating that. I'm not hallucinating. It's really self-evident. So it's a divine arrangement, and it puts me in a point in the situation of, again, awe and wonder, and like, wow, what comes next after awe and wonder? I have to surrender to that awe and wonder. And eventually it's personified in a particular person, but I think that's an important preliminary step. Now, before surrender, there has to be awe and wonder. If there is no awe and wonder, and you are captivating and you are calling in an irresistible way by having an undeniable epiphany, then the so-called surrender can be some coercive, forced, sometimes even codependent thing done out of social pressure or who knows what, fear. That's not surrender. Rufolo, that's not real surrender. So anyhow, some thoughts in connection to your initial question regarding this particular verse, and beyond this particular verse or this particular topic, I think it's important to keep in mind these ideas when, as you mentioned, we are confronted, so to say, by statements in the scripture which may seem challenging. Part of the important part of the relationship between student and teacher is that, like, I find some challenges in the scripture, and I go to my teacher because this statement is disturbing me, and your teacher sheds light on that statement in a way that, oh, what was disturbing me now is nourishing me. Wow, incredible. And that's an epiphany unto itself again, and that puts us in a place of awe and wonder. And that opens for us the landscape, like, wow, that's how life operates. Now, whatever is at present disturbing me can potentially nourish me, can potentially become a source of awe and wonder, provided I have the proper lens to approach it. And in part, being connected with guru and sadhus is that, not trying to gain the proper vision. Not only guru explaining me Shastra, but sometimes guru explaining us guru, no? Because sometimes our teacher may say something that disturbs us and we need further clarification, and that's part of the ongoing conversation that takes us to different layers of further clarification and awe and wonder and further surrender, and that never stops. That's my point. That doesn't just need to happen in the beginning. Like, oh, I find awe and wonder with this person, I surrender. And after that surrender, no more awe and wonder. No, it went bankrupt. Awe and wonder. We have bankruptcy of awe and wonder now. That's not the idea. That's how the whole progress journey should happen, in terms of awe and wonder and surrender to that awe and wonder, and further awe and wonder and surrender to that awe forever. I mean, if you analyze the Leela, all of the inhabitants of Vrindavan are in constant awe and wonder, Krishna himself. I mean, and every step there is a nuance to discover and to serve and to explore. And rasa sar chamatkar, says the scriptures. No? The very essence of rasa, rasa is the highest expression of love, bhakti rasa. Rasa sar, the essence of that is chamatkar, which means astonishment, wonder. So that remains the essence of love. So if that remains the essence of love forever, that should be there even in the very beginnings of our love journey, so to say, and should continue taking new shapes along the way. So anyhow, got thank lost you. And found by the topic, so thank you.
I really appreciate it. That clarified a lot. Thank you.
Okay, I'm happy. Thank you. Thank you. So, who else? Madhav.
Pranam, Maharaj. Maharaj, I want to ask a question regarding the topic Mantrartha Chintanam. Like, there are many acharyas who mentioned this topic, Bhaktivinoda Thakur and even Sanatan Goswami and the previous acharyas.
Which topic can you repeat? Because the audio went off. Mantra, did you say mantra and something else? I didn't hear.
Mantra Artha Chintanam, like meditating on the meaning of the name while
okay.
Chanting. So I just want to know how would this concept apply to japa as well as kirtan? because both these limbs are slightly different in their execution. So how does this topic, how does this particular act of Mantrartha Chintanam apply to these two in like their different executions?
Okay. Now a few things we can say. Of course, the notion you refer to, it's not can take different forms. But there's not only one way to do it. Not like to reflect on the meaning of the mantra, for example. When you can do it at times where you are chanting, where you are actually engaging in kirtan or japa, or you can do them when you are not doing that, like when we are doing now. We will now be reflecting on that without being, hopefully none of you have your japa mala in your hand at this moment. No. So, but just in case, raise your hands. I have my gun there. I think we'll begin every Stagostin that way, just in case for now. Anyhow, it's hilarious and we are laughing not to cry because I've seen that a few times. Yeah. Those are the dangers of Zoom. You don't see anyone's hands, so you don't know what's going on below the screen there. So yeah, that's the idea. When we are chanting just in case. Now we are not in a Zoom meeting. We are not checking social media. We are not having breakfast. No, try to give your mind to what you are doing. That will be the beginning of mantra chintanam. No, like you cannot contemplate anything if you are not giving your full attention to that. Also, we can begin explaining that in that way. No, like when you're practicing japa or kirtan, engaging with the name, just do that. No, I've seen sometimes devotees chanting japa while there is harikata, chanting japa while there is kirtan, or all these possible combinations where you become a multitasking, dysfunctional bhakta, basically. We are carrying our multitasking dynamics into the realm of bhajan, and that shouldn't happen. And multitasking is a new phenomenon, and that's not a healthy one. Now, when we become capable of doing so many things at the same time, but in one sense, we are not doing any of them in substance, in depth. But we develop the capacity of doing many things superficially. So as time progresses, we become more capable of doing even more things, even more superficially. So the more things we can do, the more superficial we'll become. And that's not the idea. No? In Krishna consciousness, the idea is that you become more deeper and deeper, not more and more superficial. And sometimes that takes time, quality presence, and focus. Whether you're chanting, whether you are talking with another person, we are developing a relationship, which chanting is all about that. Chanting is developing a relationship. Remember, it's not you doing something, but it's you talking with someone else. Don't forget that there is someone else included in the equation. It's not just we attaining something, we struggling with, we only us doing something. It's a two-way street. So to meditate on the name or to contemplate the meaning of the name, again, it can take different ways. One of them, again, is to be fully present for the name when we are trying to address it, when we are trying to relate with it. Also, it's important to contemplate the, not only will be the meaning of the name in terms of what Krishna means, the all-attractive, what the all-attractive means. And because in one sense also, if you are trying to engage in that unfolding while chanting, it can become a distraction in oneself also. Well, okay, all attractive mean this and this mean that. And you start to, in one sense, think about that while chanting, but somehow you are doing two things at this point. No? There's like a divergence there. So I will say that one of the ways I generally recommend to engage in this practice is that you engage in that before entering the practice. Like contemplate what's, not so much even what's the meaning of each name, but what's the name? What's the identity of the name? how the name is not different from the named. Abhina tvam namanam, you know, spend some time ruminating on that, not intellectualizing necessarily, but just trying to contemplate that prayerfully. And then you can enter into the chanting, so to say. I think that's important. That's, as we were talking before, preliminary actions to Saranagati. Okay, preliminary actions to the chanting. And I would, in one sense, for me, I wouldn't make that much of a difference between japa and kirtan. Of course, I'm not saying it's exactly the same in every way, but in one sense, both are, in principle, the same thing, in the sense that I'm developing my relationship with Krishna in both. That's what should be happening in both. No? Japa is not, again, it's not just repeating something in my mouth and in my mind, doing the laundry list and going who knows where, no? Or doing something else while I'm doing japa. And kirtan is not just musical entertainment, because that can happen also. So there should be a preliminary preparation before entering kirtan or entering japa, ideally. It's not like, okay, pick your instruments and let's rock it, so to say. That's why generally, traditionally, and ideally, in my opinion, Harikatha should be there in between kirtan. No. Sometimes the boat is organized like, I don't know, 37-hour kirtan. I'm exaggerating the timing a little bit. Sometimes it's 8-hour kirtan, 6-hour. And I have nothing against that. It's beautiful. But I will put this, like, interludes, so to say, in between. In the beginning, hey, guys, okay, we are reuniting here. We're engaging in this yajna. It's a yajna. Sankirtan is a yajna. So what's yajna? There is a fire. There is a sacrifice that is to be put into the fire. What we are supposed to put into the fire? We will have a nice time. We will sing together. It will be fun. Okay, but that's not all. So what's Sankirtan about? Now, what are we supposed to do in 5 minutes? What we are about to do here? Let's not lose sight of that. And then we do the Sankirtan, and after the Sankirtan, probably we may have lost sight of what we were supposed to do. So let's talk about it again before our next song, so to say. So it doesn't end up being a concert or something like that, because if not, it becomes more and more concert-like. And sometimes even kirtaniyas end up being like rock stars. I've seen that. I mean, I'm talking based on experience. I'm not pointing to anyone, condemning anything, but just like, I mean, the name of Krishna is not just the external sound. Bhaktivinoda Thakur will say that. Namakshkar Nahirhai Namar Bahirhai. He say, the letters may be sounding, but that's not Srinam. So the name of Krishna has to be accompanied by a certain spirit of invocation. If not, that's not the name of Krishna. Atha Sri Krishna Namadi Navabhridgahyam Indriyai Sebon Mukehi Jivadosvayameva Spuratida, says Rupa Goswami. The name of Krishna, everything related to Krishna, is transcendental to our senses. You cannot touch it. So it's like, oops. And then he says, but if you have the proper attitude of seva, it all begins through your tongue. Krishna manifests fully there. But he mentions seva unmukhe. You have to be inclined towards giving pleasure to the object of your affection. If that's not there, that's not kirtan. That's not nam. Not to condemn anyone, just to establish a principle. Kirtaniya, what's a kirtaniya? Kirtaniya is not someone who sings nicely. Kirtaniya is someone who follows kirtaniya sadahari. As much as you follow that principle, you are a kirtaniya. It's not about singing nicely and living a lifestyle which is not aligned with what all these principles. And I don't want to sound, oh, Maharaj, enter into strict smashing sannyas mode, and it's like, no, it's not about that. It's just, we don't want to cheat ourselves, basically. We don't want to take these things cheaply. And these are the most high, valuable, and cherished practices and ideals we have. So we don't want to how to say, downplay, no, like boil down, no, what's the expression? Like dilute. Now we don't want to dilute this high good thing. So I will emphasize that in terms of contemplating the name and the meaning of the name. What's the name? What's the name first? Well, what's the name? It's a person. It's not a name only. It's not a sound. It's an entity. And it's inviting me for a relationship. So what? How I'm showing up for the relationship? In which terms do I want to establish the relationship? All that requires contemplation. You have to take time for that. And that all that is necessary. But not necessarily maybe during the time of the chanting, but during the rest of your day, so to say. And then you go to chanting with that contemplation, with that spirit, and you pay attention to the name, you open to the sound, with all that contemplation in the background. So naturally, that will invite the name to show itself, himself, herself, themselves, as they are, so to say. No? So I will point that, emphasize that both in Japa and in Kirtan in its own way. I think it's important that we take some time to, as we say before, in terms of guru, it's important that we get educated about guru tattva. In terms of Japa or Kirtan, it's important that we get educated in terms of nam tattva. And it's not just receiving concepts again, but committing ourselves to the relationship. The concept is there to make you committed in the relation. The concept comes and tells you the name is not a name, it's a person. And this is the person, and this is the relationship that this person wants to have with you. What about you? You want to have that relationship? What that takes, what it takes to have that relationship with such a person? And then you are thrown into a notion of introspection after that. You have to really think and pray and align your life as if you want, it's voluntary, about that. And that takes time. That's a job. That's a task. No? And that's part of the chanting. So in that way, our chanting is not just the moment we are chanting, but all that is happening around the chanting and in the context of the chanting and before the chanting and after the chanting and between the chanting. So I don't know, hopefully this doesn't make you feel, Maharaj, this is impossible. So now you have given me full discouragement to continue chanting. That's not the idea. And it's a gradual process. It's a gradual process. No, no, don't think this will happen in a lifetime even. No. Don't enter into that trip. No. It will develop. It will unfold forever, actually. For eternity, the name of Krishna will take a new meaning forever. Even if you are in the Leela, no, you hear the name of Krishna, that will mean something different every day for you. So I will try to emphasize that. So we don't make it like an elitistic type of technical thing. Okay, I will now sit and meditate, contemplate the meaning of the mantra according to, I don't know, Sanskrit grammar. Krishna means this and Ram means that, Agambinda means that, and I'm now doing what Bhaktivinoda Thakur is requesting me to do, which is contemplate the meaning of the name. Because we can do that from that place also, and end up becoming more arrogant and proud by thinking I'm very paka in how I'm engaging in my mantra chintanam. No. And nobody else is doing it like me. And we totally miss what we are talking about now, which is the actual essence of what does it mean to contemplate the meaning of the mantra. Again, the meaning and purpose. So the mantra is a person, remember. Try to establish always that immediate link. The mantra, the name, is a person. Remain personal. Well, let's be radically personal. If we relate to the name without relating to the name as a person, we are being impersonal, basically. That's impersonalism. If I chant the name without understanding, I'm developing my relation with Krishna. At that moment, at least, I'm being impersonal on a functional level. So we say, the meaning of the mantra, contemplate the meaning of the mantra. The mantra is a person. So what's the meaning of the person? Means what's the purpose of the person? What's the intention of the person? Krishna, coming to my life. From which place he's coming? From which place I respond? That's for me the real contemplation of the mantra, the playing out of the implications of all that. So I hope that helps, Madhav. But this time you already know that I may probably give not the most predictable answers. I'm not saying that's better. I'm just saying that's who I am. Sorry.
Thank you so much. That was definitely unpredictable, but at the same time, that was very much needed. And I think that was one of the best advices I've ever got on chanting, whether it be japa or kirtan. Thank you
very much. Hari Naam Prabhu Ki Jai. Okay. Who else? Swetadip Radhika has raised hands, or Amanda Bikram in the back. I don't know who of the two. I'm just seeing a digital hand, so...
Hi Krishna, thank you Maharaj. It's me. Yes, my questions regarding desiring to go to the spiritual world. So recently I was hearing someone talk about this. They were saying how they don't desire to go to the spiritual world. Rather, like, you know, they just want to be serving wherever they are, you know, something like that. And I was thinking, because they were saying, if we desire to go to the spiritual world, that means that's for our own enjoyment and not like for the pleasure of Krishna. And so then I was thinking, you know, there are sometimes we hear like we should like desire, like intensely desire to see Krishna, to get a service in Goloka Vrindavan. And then we also hear this. So, you know, so I was thinking like, okay, so what's the right thing, you know, as in, I mean, these also seem like really like elevated like ideas, right? I mean, not something I'm contemplating on a daily basis, but when I heard this, I thought about it and I was just wondering like, you know, they seem kind of contradicting. If you want to share something on that.
Yeah. Thank you. I will say, one says the last chapter of the book of Radical Personalism, in part, I talk quite a lot about that. Just a related reading suggestion. But yeah, in one sense, we have this idea in our tradition to begin with, of course, that devotees do not care for liberation. Of course, one can make a distinction between liberation and going to the spiritual world. But let's begin there briefly. No? Mahaprabhu will say, for example, Nadanam Najanam Nasundarim Kavitamba. So he's saying, I don't care for Dharma, Artha, Kama, nor Moksha, basically. So he doesn't care for followers and money and enjoyment here, but also he doesn't care for getting out of here. Because moksha means that, liberation. So that makes the point that bhakti is not about liberation. Our goal is not moksha, mukti. And one of the muktis, because one could say, no, yeah, we don't care for impersonal liberation. No, but moksha and mukti is fivefold, as you may know. No? Sarupya, not only sayujya, no? But sarupya, samipya, sarsti, and Salokya, mentioned in the Bhagavatam, which means to go to the spiritual world. Salokya, to reside in a planet with Bhagavan is to have his opulence or to, and so on and so forth. So that one may apply that to Vaikuntha and not to Golok. Again, you have all these types of ways of explaining this. But at the end of the day, you have to agree that our Siddhanta is, we don't care for mukti in principle. In practice, still probably we care a lot. In practice, many devotees still are like, I want to get rid from this world. I want to transcend samsara. I want to stop suffering. Krishna, help me. And that's my main motivating factor yet, still. So some of us, I've heard that. But yeah, in principle, that's not the idea. But I can understand in some particular situations, we may be in different stages of the journey. But in one sense, the idea is that bhakti is a post-liberated issue or project. In other words, we practice bhakti for further bhakti. No, we don't practice bhakti for something else because there is no something else. In brief, if there will be something else, that something else will be the real thing. But for us, bhakti is the real thing, to the point that there's nothing else to attain apart from further bhakti. Just bhakti in more condensed stages, so to say, like Rupa Goswami describes sadhana bhakti. What's sadhana bhakti? He will describe sadhana bhakti as nitya siddhasya bhavasya prakatyam hridi sadhyata. Sadhana bhakti is that which takes you to bhava bhakti. So he's saying this type of bhakti takes you to that type of bhakti. We are only moving to different types of bhakti, but bhakti is always the constant. Bhaktya sanjatiya bhaktya, says the Bhagavatam. Bhakti comes from bhakti, and bhakti goes to bhakti. No, there's nothing else. So my point with all this is, and there are different verses in the scriptures, again, which not only say we don't care for liberation. I remember I quote in this chapter that I told you last one on radical personalism, in the 10th canto, chapter 83, verse 41, Rukmini is saying that devotees do not care, again, for mundane opulence, for whatever, mystical powers. They don't care for immortality. And then she says they don't even care for Hare Padam, which means entrance into the spiritual world. So that's kind of shocking, because again, it seems to contradict, hey, but we were supposed to want to go there and serve in Golok Vrindavan. So when these statements are there, it doesn't mean that the devotee is against that. No, it's not like, I hate Golok Vrindavan. I don't want to go there. No, I want just, what do you want then? Of course. So the idea is I want to serve and I want to serve more and more. And basically to put it in a certain way, and I know this can be complicated to understand, but my point is the following. What's the spiritual world? The spiritual world basically is a state of consciousness. So when you reach that state of consciousness, you are there. Well, like if I will ask you, when Srila Prabhupada was here on earth, geographically speaking, would you say he was in the spiritual world or not? Probably you will say yes. So how he can be in a spiritual world and be here at the same time? And probably you will say, because internally he was pure devotee and constant. So you will connect being in the spiritual world to a state of consciousness. You follow my point. And when you have that state of consciousness, also we could say that has a corresponding spiritual planet that you can reside in. But it's to begin with a state of consciousness. If you don't have that state of consciousness, you will never go there. But again, going there... it's not a physical movement. I know that it's difficult for us to understand because we used to conceive everything in three dimensions. So going to the spiritual world for us is like some spaceship will come and will take us upstairs, this amount of kilometers, and we will go beyond planet Earth and beyond this galaxy and finally reach Golok Vrindavan. And all is conceived in physical terms of distance, ups, but it's a movement in terms of consciousness. It's not a physical movement. It's difficult to understand. But that's the spiritual world. Srila Srila Maharaj will say Vrindavan is a state of consciousness. It's not a place. It's not a geographical location. It's a consciousness location. And that's why he said, as you know, when Prabhupada left Vrindavan, physically, the geographical Vrindavan. And some people was asking him, but why are you leaving Vrindavan? I mean, you're almost 70 years. People come at your age to die in Vrindavan. And you're leaving Vrindavan at that age. It makes no sense. And so the Samaras will say, well, those who think like that, despite they were living in Vrindavan physically, they were not living in Vrindavan internally, substantially, because they couldn't understand that someone like Prabhupada was never living Vrindavan. He was just extending Vrindavan's presence to every corner of the planet because he was internally in Vrindavan. So all this to say is that when a devotee says, I don't care to go to the spiritual world, I only care to serve, actually, both are synonymous. No. I mean, spiritual, going in the spiritual world means being in a certain place of service, in a certain state of service. So I think we should like try to, how to say, to bridge the gap, instead of thinking, okay, one thing is going to the spiritual world, another thing is staying here for service, so to say. No. But if you're really aligned with what actual service means, that will bring you closer and closer to what we officially define as being in the spiritual world. So it's, they're not the one is against the other. And you cannot go, quote unquote, to the spiritual world for something else than for pure absolute service. There's no other way to go. Like you were saying, no, you want to go to spiritual world to enjoy. That's an oxymoron. That's a contradiction of terms. You cannot enter a place like that with enjoying a spirit. There's no place for that. No. Of course, we can make the point, I don't want to go to Golok to exploit Golok, but also immediately we'll say, but that's not possible even. I appreciate the statement. I don't want to go to a spiritual world yet because I will be exploiting everything. But immediately the clarification is, you will never be able to enter in that way either. So don't make a problem. You won't be there. If you choose to remain exploiter, you won't be there. You are not there yet. And when you are in the proper internal place, aligned fully with what it means, with the quality of service that is found in Golok Vrindavan, let's say, you are there. That's the point. No? We hear so many descriptions of devotees on earth, so to say, in this body, awakening to their spiritual identity. So a spiritual identity is not isolated from an environment of service. Now, if you realize that you are such and such gopi or gopal, so to say, that realization happens in the context of a whole environment, which means you are there. You follow? It's not like, okay, I realize that I'm such manjari, but I just realized that absolutely in isolation with everything else that happens in Golok Vrindavan. It doesn't work like that. When you have a glimpse of who you are eternally, you have a glimpse of the whole paraphernalian environment that is accompanying you. So in that sense, you are already there, or you are beginning to be there. Again, it's difficult. I know words are limiting always. But you are beginning to participate there, so to say, more and more. And we are already in that process. That's my point. You don't need to just wait for having an epiphany of what's my Gopa name in Golok to start to feel I'm part of this. No, we are the day one of our practice is a way of starting to participate in that. Not in a sahaja way, imitating and thinking I'm this, I'm that, in a fictional way, but to feel myself part of that. You know, as much as you can relate to what's going on in the Leela, for example, you feel part of that in some way. You feel that I can, I. So the more you feel part of something, you are participating in that. Well, I remember that was one of the main points in the last lecture, the radical personalism series, how to relate with the Leelas in a way that is relatable and applicable to whatever we are now. And that takes us to a further degree of participation. So again, when we say we want to go to the spiritual world, if we say that, again, we should be saying that from a place of rendering a particular type of service. But for that to happen, we have to do something here and now. It all begins here and now. Because sometimes we may also use this, I want to go to the spiritual world as an, again, as an evasive, as an, how do you call it? Like an evacuation plan in the afterlife. No, like, I want to go there so I don't have to deal with this and this and this stuff here. Or I want to go to the spiritual world to, again, you won't reach there if in that case. Now, the only way we can reach the spiritual world is by reaching it here, by understanding it's a state of consciousness, it's a mood of service, that I'm to cultivate in the here and now, today, and tomorrow develop it, and the day after tomorrow develop it. And gradually I will find myself there. I will eventually realize my eternal identity in the Lila, and everything will follow from that, and so on and so forth. It doesn't have to be like an extra concern apart from that. So the actual concern is what I'm doing today, April 27th, 2024, to get closer to that spirit of service that is the norm in Golok, so to say. That's how I'm advancing. That's my going to the spiritual world. Again, going doesn't mean I was here and suddenly transferred there. Going is ongoing affair. I'm going. Like if I say I'm here in North Carolina, Lake Lure, what I'm saying, and I'm going to Asheville, which is a town 45 minutes by car, and I'm calling my friend, I'm going. So I'm going means I'm going. It's not that I'm there. I'm starting to go, and it will take time to reach there, but I'm going. So going to the spiritual world is an ongoing affair. And the only way I will eventually officially reach there is by doing something today, by doing what I need to do today. And that will take me to what I need to do tomorrow, and so on and so forth. That's how we progress, is step by step. It's not like a sudden transference, and I suddenly am here, as I say sometimes even sarcastically. No, like, no, you chant your 16 round, follow your four regulative principles, and even if you don't have any concentration and no faith and no love, you will be at the end of your life thrown into Golok, and you will arrive there and have no clue where to go, what to do, which is my department, and someone at the entrance will tell you, okay, you have been assigned to this particular kunja, this is your identity. You ask that guy what to do. It doesn't happen like that, right? We have to start being part of that now. We have to enter there now. We are going there gradually. And in that organic unfolding, eventually, everything will be in place and clear and revealed and manifested. That's how it generally happens, at least. So I hope that helps. So to the Radhika, I don't know, you tell me. Makes any sense?
Yeah, yes, Maharaj, a lot. It was really very helpful. Just one thing I was thinking in connection to what you were saying regarding how it's not a physical place and a state of consciousness. It makes sense to me, but I was thinking some places where Srila Prabhupada has said, if you're trying to go to Brahmaloka, it would take like 40,000 billion years or something like that, you know? So it sounds like it's a physical travel in that sense.
Yeah, because Brahmaloka is a material planet. That's a different thing. That's a planet of Brahma.
So, okay.
Those are other laws that are governing there. We're speaking about spiritual world. The very expression says it, a spiritual world. It's a world made of a spirit. It's not made of matter. So it's a world in spirit. Now, spiritual world means you achieve there that place in spirit, in consciousness. No? Vaikuntha Prithividyadi said Kali Chinmay, said Chaitanya Charitamrita. From Vaikuntha upwards, even the soil is made of transcendental chintamani, like touchstone. So it's making the point that here we are talking about a categorically different type of reality, so to say. Again, I know it's beyond our heads, and if we try to use our imagination to conceive that, our imagination is limited because we can only imagine what we have experienced so far. And we have never experienced so far spiritual world, no? Just in case we are not coming from Golok or something like that. Our imagination cannot help. So the idea is just opening ourselves from another system of revelation and inspiration and divine descent and grace and so on and so forth. So thank you. Thank you for your question. So we have one more hand raised. Sham is there. Nice to see you, Sham. So you can unmute yourself if you have any questions.
Am I audible?
I don't hear you that well, so try to, I don't know, maybe talk as close as you can to the computer or cell phone and as loud as you can.
Is it audible now?
Yeah.
Manish, my question was, I was when I was reading Radical Personalism, there you have mentioned about toxic femininity and toxic masculinity. So you were thinking that how toxic femininity sometimes comes in the form of victim consciousness. So I wanted to understand, Maharaj, that whenever we are faced with a difficulty, it's easier for us to get into victim consciousness whenever we are faced with a difficulty. So how do we remind ourselves that victim consciousness is not going to help us in any way? How do we make a balance out of it? Because sometimes it's very comforting to get into a victim consciousness and continue to be a victim at the hands of a difficulty. How do we balance that?
Okay, thank you. So yeah, we mentioned that in the Radical Personalism book, that of course vulnerability, because that was a little bit in the context of the conversation and vulnerability and empowerment. So vulnerability is a very, of course, potentially empowering attribute, and it's feminine in nature to be vulnerable. But everything has its toxic counterpart or expression, no? So like the toxic femininity in that in this case, or the toxic expression of vulnerability, it will be basically victim consciousness, no? Where I'm not saying that some people may not be a victim of certain things. No, I'm not saying that. You can be victims of abuse and so many things, and that has to be properly acknowledged, but you are a victim means that something happened to you in a particular situation. Victim consciousness means I take victim as my identity, so to say. No? Like I live as a victim throughout my whole life because of what happened in this particular point, so to say, or this many particular points. And I don't want to sound insensitive. I can understand that in some cases, people have had very intense experiences of, I don't know, abuse, being victims to that. And even if you, especially if you are young, that kind of becomes your only point of reference because you're just experiencing one abuse after another. You are a victim, one victim after another. So at one point, it's just like, well, it seems that's who I am. So you like convince yourself, like, I'm a victim. And you don't know how to live your life from any other place. I'm not criticizing that person. I'm just trying to show empathy and understanding. But still, in that case, that doesn't work. No, it's toxic in that sense. It's not something that helps us to flourish and blossom as we have the potential to be. But of course, we don't need to be to have gone an excessively traumatized childhood to play the victim. It's so easy for any of us to do it immediately, because in one sense it's the easiest thing to do in the immediate. In the immediate, mid and long term is the most difficult thing to sustain. If you choose to keep your to sustain that sense of identity forever, that's unsustainable. That's so toxic that, I mean, the point with the main problem with victim consciousness that I think I mentioned in my book is that it goes basically against the principle of person of taking responsibility for yourself. Because there is always someone else to blame, so to say. And victim consciousness is also very tied to what's sometimes called the cult of innocence. I also refer to that in my book, which means like some other person was abused, and I like empathize with that person. Oh, you have been so abused. Yes, and he did that to you. And you are trying kind of subtracting the victimhood of that person and ascribe that to you. Like I'm better person because I'm identifying with that. That can happen. I mean, that's very different from being empathic and sensitive towards someone else is being abused. That's perfectly fine. But unconsciously, sometimes we can engage in this cult of innocence when we just condemn what other people did to other people, but as a way of confirming how good I am, so to say, because of how much I identify with other victims. instead of taking responsibility for my own life, so to say. So it's subtle, but that can happen. So at the end of the day, I think it's important that we are reminded that to be human and to be living, to exist as a living, real person, means to take responsibility. We have a commitment not only to our own potential, we have a commitment to our own existence. So victim consciousness is kind of an evasiveness of taking responsibility for life. In which sense? To give an example, for example, I don't know, someone has gone through an abuse, no? Like someone was abused as a child by an elder. No, let's go to one of the most undesirable things that someone may have to go through, and that can happen, unfortunately. That has happened. So you have been a victim of abuse. We are not denying that. But still, when having been abused, you have two choices here. One is, I choose to remain a victim forever, like entering into that character because I have been a victim. I am a victim forever because I was abused by this person and that made me a victim and that keeps me a victim. So do not expect anything from me because I was abused in this way and I'm a victim. So that's who I am. And you have to validate my victimhood, because if you don't validate that, you're being violent, so on and so forth. And nowadays in our current society, there is so much of that, even on ridiculous levels, even if you haven't been abused or anything, but if you don't validate how I feel about myself, you are being violent towards me and I will make you a legal case for you or something. So that's one choice. I'm being genuine victim of some situation, but still I have the choice to choose how to respond to that. So that's the point. Do I choose to take personal responsibility for my own feelings in that situation, or do not take responsibility for that and just remain playing the victim? Like, I'm a victim. This happened to me. This was done to me. He's bad or they are bad. I'm the victim. I'm trying to find validation and support because of the abuse you have received, which actually shouldn't define who you are fully. That's my point. The ideal situation will be, no, I have been victim of abuse. I acknowledge that, and I need support, and I need to grieve, and I need to go through my period, but I take responsibility of how I choose to feel about it. I can decide in so many directions how to feel about it. Can I become resentful, hateful, cynical, or cynic? I can lose face of everyone. I can be stupid enough to not learn from the lesson and do the same thing over and over again. So many things can happen. Or I can take responsibility from the situation. This has happened to me for some reason. I have to learn some lesson from this. So next time I behave in a more mature way, I take personal responsibility not to be hateful and resentful, but also I take responsibility my own emotions of what I'm going through, and I need to sit with my emotions, as complex as that may be. I'm deciding to do that. I'm taking responsibility. This is happening to me. Okay, I have to, what to do with that? How to grow with that? So that's not victim consciousness. No, you acknowledge you were victim, you acknowledge you were whatever, abused or cheated. This happened to me. This has been difficult. I'm still healing my wounds from that. I may need time to recover, to heal, to do therapy, whatever the case. I take responsibility for that. It's up to me to heal. I cannot expect the other person. That's my point. Not like if I was, I don't know, betrayed by someone, let's put it like that. To play the victim is to disempower yourself, because it's a way of saying, he abused me and I'm a victim. And indirectly you're saying, unless and until that person comes and beg forgiveness and changes, I remain a victim. I'm still who I am. So you are giving more power to that person who probably will never change in some cases, or will not do what I am expecting to do. So by depending on others' reaction for you to move forward, so to say, that's not healthy. That's a form of codependency. So it's important that, yeah, I've been hurt, I've been betrayed, I've been abused, I've been a victim in that sense. But now I'm taking a healthy distance from this situation, and it's up to me to decide, what do I want to do with my life? How do I want to deal with what I'm feeling, with my prospect? And even with that person, if eventually that person shows up, beg forgiveness or never that so, okay, I have to align my life in a way that is not like depending on what the other person is doing. Again, I'm talking in general. Each situation is complex and has so many details. And I'm not saying this is easy. If we have in a close relationship with someone and there was some form of abuse or betrayal, and I know it for myself, of course, you are expecting something from the other person. It was close to you. You love the person a lot. You cannot just like press a button and, okay, you are there. I'm here. My life can, I mean, it takes time. All these are processes. But still in those processes, nobody can decide for us. So victim consciousness means basically being trapped in the past, like justifying your lack of response, personal responsibility in connection to how bad someone else is. Weak faith requires an enemy, as they say. So yeah, those will be some thoughts in terms of how we can like push ourselves beyond victim consciousness. And this is not only for you, of course, Sham, it's for everyone, because it's so easy to fall into that. And on so many levels, there are so many levels to that. But it's tied to this idea of taking personal responsibility. Yeah, some other people may be doing things to us, they may be saying things about us, but still it's up to me to decide what to do. It's not up to them. They won't decide that. So in that sense, I'm empowered, but also I have to take the decision. And many of us, to be honest, many of us are terrified about personal responsibility. In situations like this, we may realize, oh my gosh, I just want, for so many times, I was more comfortable having others deciding for me, telling me what to do, what to think, what to feel, where to go, how to dress, everything. And it was I was accomplice to that somehow. I was allowing that to happen and compromising my freedom, not developing my individuality. And now in this situation, I'm forced to continue to engage with that pattern even more toxically and become addict and dependent on that, or realize, okay, I decide now. And nobody else can decide apart from me. I have to, that's what makes me an individual being. If that will be taken away from me, I will become inert stuff, so to say. So to honor that also, that's my, as terrifying as that prospect is, you have to decide. It's beautiful and it's empowering. And we have to take the steps. And even if we decided in a direction that we realize, oh, probably that was not the best decision. Okay, you decide in a wiser way the next time. That's how life operates. That's how we grow and mature. By deciding, sometimes making mistakes and learning from those mistakes. And if we learn from a mistake, how much that's a mistake. So we shouldn't be afraid of personal responsibility. No? So sometimes victim consciousness is, again, unconsciously a way of escaping from that and remaining in kindergarten forever. So, but that's not what we want. So I hope that helps. A few words in that connection. Thank you so much. And yeah, we have no more raised hands. I know that there's one question that was sent to me before the meeting by Daniel, a friend of us that is not able to connect, do it live. But with Daniel's permission, I will leave that for the next meeting, because maybe next meeting, Bhakti Rasa, you remind me about that and we can begin with his question, because I didn't know there will be all these questions and I will go for that long either. So excuse me, Daniel, for that. I hope you can wait for one more week. And next Saturday, we'll begin with Daniel's question, which was in connection to Ekadasi. And actually, I think next Saturday is Ekadasi. So that, I think that will be a good proper way to to honor his question and begin our Istagosti next Saturday. So thank you so much to all of you. And also before we conclude here, just brief reminder, a few activities we'll be having this coming week. One of them being this Wednesday, we have shifted our Free Radical podcast from Mondays to Wednesdays, first and third Wednesday of each month. So I'll be sharing the beautiful conversation we had with Father Richard Ward. This Wednesday, that will be the podcast with Father Richard. So hopefully you can connect. He's a very wise person and special mentor in my life. So I assume you will be happy with that, with watching that one. And also, next Thursday, May 2nd, as part of our Tadatmya Sangha series of presentations, we have had these bi-weekly lectures on different topics. But the idea is starting from May, we also will be having one monthly presentation. We will take three or four lectures throughout the month, once per week. So the first presentation of this kind will be presented by Deva Madhava Prabhu, and he will be expanding on the topic he presented on his weekly presentation on the Bhakti's Bill of Rights. So that will start this Thursday for the next three Thursdays of May. So if you have a chance, that will be at 8 a.m. EDT time. So if you have a chance, you can connect live via Zoom. This requires some subscription in advance, so you can connect. I've shared all that information yesterday in social media, so just in case mentioning here it again. But you can connect through that. And we'll be starting to have this type of presentations, also adding that to our Tadatmya offering every month. So again, thanks to all of you. Pranam, thank you so much for being there as usual. Presence, questions, listening, affection, openness, Tadatmya, empathy. I'm looking forward to see you next Saturday. Sri Sachinandan Gaur Hari Ki Jai. Shri Hari Nam Prabhu Ki Jai. Shri Shri Gaur Nityanand Ki Jai. Shri Shri Gaur Gadadhar Ji Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Madan Mohan Ki Jai. Radha Govinda Dev Ki Jai. Shri Radha Gopinath Ji Ki Jai. Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Gaur Premanand Hari Hari Bol Vancha Kalpataru Vishcha. Vipa Sindhu Vyayiva Chapatitanam Pavanipya Vaishnavibhya Namo. Ananta Koti Vaishna Vrinda Ki Jai. Gaur Hari Bol. Thank you so much.